Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Olivia Porter, one of the hosts of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Sam Van Schaik about his new book, Buddhist Magic, Divination, Healing, and Enchantment Through the Ages, published by Shambhala in 2020. Sam is the head of the Endangered Archives Programme at the British Library and has previously worked on the International Dunhuang Project, also at the British Library. He specialises in the study of Tibetan Buddhist scripts from Dunhuang. His new book, Buddhist Magic, is an exploration of the role that magic has played in the history of Buddhism. As far back as we can see in the historical record, Buddhist monks and nuns have offered services including healing, divination, rainmaking, aggressive magic and love magic to local clients. Sam argues that magic and healing have played a key role in Buddhism's flourishing, yet they have rarely been studied in academic circles or by Western practitioners. The exclusion of magical practices and powers from most discussions of Buddhism in the modern era can be seen as part of the appropriation of Buddhism by Westerners, as well as an effect of modernization movements within Asian Buddhism. However, if we are to understand the way Buddhism has worked in the past, the way it still works now in many societies, and the way it can work in the future, we need to examine these overlooked aspects of Buddhist practice. In Buddhist Magic, Sam takes a book of spells and rituals, one of the earliest that has survived from the Silk Road site of Dunhuang, as the key reference point for discussing Buddhist magic in Tibet and beyond. Welcome to the podcast, Sam.
Thanks, Olivia.
I was wondering if we could kick this off by maybe you telling us a bit about your background and how you came to Buddhist studies.
Yes, sure. So I was, I suppose I could go as far back as in my teens in the 80s when I was living in Kathmandu because my father was working there in the international aid project. And that was about 3 years of my life. And at that time, as you may know, in the Bodha Stupa area, there was quite a large Tibetan exile community. And so I was somewhat exposed to that, although at that point not particularly inclined to practice Buddhism or study it, but certainly had an effect. And later on, I was able to spend quite a lot of time in Bhutan because my parents were working there in the early 90s. So that was an early exposure to Buddhism, especially the Tibetan form of Buddhism. And then going into university a little later, I did comparative religion and specialized in Buddhism in the final years and did the Tibetan Buddhist course at Manchester, which was run by David Stott, who was also practicing as a Buddhist teacher, as Lama Jumpa Taye. So I both studied with him and began to study Buddhist practice and meditation with him, both as an academic teacher and as a Buddhist Lama. And then I went on to do a PhD also at Manchester on the Longchen Nyingtik, a Tibetan Dzogchen practice text, which was also the tradition which I was practicing in at the time. So all of that was done without a particularly clear career path in mind, but I was lucky enough that towards the end of the PhD, a position came up at the British Library. At that point, just for a year, to catalogue part of the Silk Road collections that were collected by Oral Stein in the early 20th century. And that was, at that point, some wooden documents from the Tibetan military back in the period of the Tibetan Empire in the 8th century. And that went on to working on Tibetan Buddhist manuscripts, the Tantric Buddhist collections from Dunhuang, to work on paleography and scripts, and working on Tibetan Zen tradition, and then more recently on this Buddhist magic topic that I've been working on before finally I left, as you said, the International Dunhuang Project and joined the Endangered Archives Program last year in February.
Okay, great. So I was wondering if you could move on to talk about what motivated you to write Buddhist magic specifically.
Yes, well, it's been a long time coming in a way, because I started a blog back in, I think, 2007, earlytibet.com, and I used that to write about interesting manuscripts I came across in cataloguing and other research work at the library. And I think probably 2010, I wrote about a book of spells, which I'd come across and not really had enough time to go into in detail. And I raised the question of, you know, how interesting it is that we find monks, Buddhist monks doing magic, and that this little book of spells has interesting things like spells to make water run upstream instead of downstream, and spells for invisibility and things like that. And that was only one post on the blog, but it was and still is the most popular, I think, both just out of interest, but also out of, I think, a concern among Western Buddhists that is this really Buddhism? Is this really true that Buddhist monks were practicing magic? So looking at the responses to that, I thought, well, this would be interesting to go into a bit more deeply and see whether there's a book to be written here. So I took that book of spells as the basis for the book, doing a thorough translation of it, and then using that translation to really jump off and look at what we mean by Buddhist magic, what we even mean by magic, and the role that it's played in the Buddhist tradition, not just Tibetan Buddhism, actually, but throughout the Buddhist tradition, throughout its history.
Great. I noticed in your introduction, you make it really clear that it's a book about magic rather than a book of magic. Could you tell us a bit about why you made that distinction so clear?
Yes, well, maybe I was a little bit too concerned that people might pick up my book and decide to start casting spells. As you mentioned at the beginning, there are a few aggressive spells, as I call them, in there, including one for bringing down a lightning or meteor strike upon somebody. So I want to make clear that I don't endorse that kind of activity, and particularly that, seriously, this is a manuscript of Buddhist practices, but it doesn't contain, there's no transmission lineage, it's not a living lineage of practice, there's no commentary, there's no Lama to give an oral instruction or contextualize it. So it's very interesting and very useful for our understanding of the practice of Buddhist magic historically, but it's not there to be practiced. So this is a book about the book of magic, but it's not something I'm putting out there for practical purposes.
Yeah, I guess it's good to make the distinction clear that you're not responsible for any strange things happening if people start taking these too seriously. Why do you think it is that Buddhist magic has been so overlooked? And what is it about Buddhist magic that's so hard to define?
Yes, two questions. So I'll answer the first one. Why has it been overlooked? So I discussed a bit in the book, this is something that Buddhism shares with other religious traditions, where there's a kind of concern that, especially since the 19th century, since modernity, since our kind of valorization of science over religion and superstition, that if we focus too much on magical traditions, it'll make our religion look like it's just a kind of another form of superstition. So this is something that has occurred elsewhere as well. In the field of Judaism, for example, there's been a unwillingness until recently to really write about the rich tradition of Jewish magic. I think for the same purposes, as a historian of that tradition, which I quote, has written about this as well. Likewise, in Buddhism, there's been a presentation of Buddhism in the West as, you know, verging on a philosophy rather than a religion, quite different from other religions because it's about ethics and it's about living a good life, and it's not about belief, and it's not about superstition. So all of the this seems to be undermined by if we focus too much on the magical side of Buddhism. I think that's the fear that's behind the lack of discussion of this material. And you asked, there was a second part to that question. Maybe you could remind me.
What makes it so hard to define?
So, I mean, what makes magic hard to define partly is that it's got such a long history. So in our tradition, it's in the Christian tradition, magic has been set against religion. So magic is what's practiced by people who don't follow the Christian tradition. And therefore, it's always been a negative thing. It's always been something to be sort of othered in terms of religion. Now, in the 19th century, there was a different use of magic, which was people like James Frazer, who came up with the model that you have magic in societies first, followed by religion, and then followed by science. So it's a clearly developmental process, and magic is at the bottom of it. And that his definitions of magic were that it's, you know, unlike organized religion, it's not an organized church, and it's to do with principles like sympathetic magic. It's to do with kind of basically misunderstandings of nature that were not to be corrected until mankind became scientific, Western mankind in particular. So the word magic does have a troubled history, and there's a lot of argument for dropping it altogether. I found it useful looking at this book of spells to start with, and then thinking about why do we call things magic? Why was it my impulse to look at this Tibetan book of spells and call it magic? And I think actually there was good reason. That's what I explore in the book. So there are other traditions across the world that have been explored using that word magic, like the Greek magical papyri, like the Chinese magical wooden slips, like cuneiform tablets from Mesopotamia. All of these have been studied in recent decades in terms of being magical texts. So in one of the chapters of the book, I do a brief review of some of this magic across the world and look at what joins them together, or to use Wittgenstein's term, what's the family resemblance that these traditions which are called magic share. And I came up with three basic principles for the study of Buddhist magic based on that and based on the Book of Spells. And the first and probably most important was that these spells, these rituals, were dedicated to the things of this life. So it's about curing people, it's about dealing with problematic people, it's about not going hungry, about successful pregnancies and childbirth, and things like that, plus the occasional wacky stuff like invisibility and flying. And this is shared with Buddhism shares it with other traditions of magic in the world. The second thing was that, unlike other religious activities, there is a very immediate relationship between the cause and effect here. So the books of spells tend to say, if you do this, if you carry out this practice, if you say these mantras and you mix up this ointment, then the patient will be cured in 2 or 3 days, or the spirit will depart immediately, or that kind of thing. So it's a much more clear and direct articulation of the effect of the spell than you get in other practices, like just making meritorious offerings or praying to a deity. So that's the second thing, that clear and immediate effect. And the third thing was looking at the manuscripts themselves, the books of spells. So again, across traditions in Buddhism, but also in medieval Europe and in Greece and in Mesopotamia, these short rituals for worldly effects were gathered together, and you see the same cluster of concerns again and again, as I said, about medicine and crops and cattle and personal relationships and that kind of thing, all kind of clustered together. You find them in books and in tablets and in scrolls and so on across the world. So those are the kind of three things that I use to define magic as I was talking about it in the book, actually coming out of the materials itself rather than a theory that I wanted to kind of impose from the beginning when selecting the materials.
One of the things that I found really interesting about this kind of cross-cultural magic overview that you did was learning about the different similarities between across cultural contexts. And some of them I found quite surprising, but I was wondering, do you think that they were the result of migration during the period, or is there some structural similarity that, you know, that's more inherent in human nature, which means that different societies come up with these very similar rituals?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's almost the primary question of the whole topic when you're looking across, you know, comparatively. Is it transmission, or is there something in human psychology and physiology that makes us come up with similar solutions to similar problems? So in some cases, I think it is just humans deal with the same issues wherever they are, and that's issues with sickness and with interpersonal relationships and with the weather and things like this, and they tend to come up with solutions for them. In other cases, though, some of the rituals do look so similar that you've got to wonder if they did spread through transmission, although very far, actually. So the one that I mention in the book as a case in point is this ritual known in Tibet as prasena, or just pra, which prasena is actually a Prakrit or Hindi word, but it came to Tibet from India. It's also there in the Chinese texts as well, which were translated from Sanskrit. And this is a divination ritual using a mirror or another reflective surface. So you can also use a shiny blade of a sword or your thumbnail if it's been covered with oil so it's shiny. And it's a ritual of gazing into the reflective surface to find the answers to your questions. Now, more specifically, though, the person doing the gazing has to be a young prepubescent child. So in this ritual, the child is installed in the ritual space, facing the mirror, and then a question is asked, and the child is told to gaze into the mirror. And then the child is questioned about what they see, and what they see is then interpreted, and that's the divination. So it's rather specific. So I found it interesting reading a bit more widely to find the same aspects of this ritual: the mirror, the child gazing, the person who is the kind of master of the ritual then questioning the child, are also found in magic in Jewish magic. They're found in Northern Africa. And a very interesting 11th century account, which I quote in the book, about a priest doing this in England, and the writer John of Salisbury, one of his students, was asked to gaze into the mirror and say what he saw by his Latin master. But then later in life, he realized that this was a practice associated with demons, and therefore he'd been asked to do something very wrong. But interestingly, it was the same elements of the ritual. So despite the fact that this is so far afield, if we go as far as China in one direction and England in the other, it's hard to not to see that this must be some kind of transmission of the same ritual across different cultures.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to talk about. I have a question going back to what you were previously saying about the reluctance to talk about Buddhist magic. Was that from Buddhist practitioners themselves, or is it scholars writing about Buddhism who avoided talking about the topic?
I think it's been both. I think there's a concern with practitioners, including Tibetan Buddhist practitioners, Tibetan Buddhist kind of advocates of Buddhism, that this topic would not cast them in a very favorable light in the West. So that was downplayed. And you see that, I mean, in the way that the Dalai Lama, for example, prefers to put Buddhism alongside science rather than emphasizing this magical aspect of it. So it's about presentation from within the tradition. But also there's the academic, there's definitely an academic unwillingness to engage with it for many decades, although that's definitely changing now. And I think partly it's a similar thing where writers in an emerging tradition, Buddhist studies not being very old, and Tibetan Buddhist studies being quite a recent part of that, to have their work taken seriously. And it's better if it kind of looks more philosophical or fits better into some kind of accepted academic departmental structure. So although recently ritual and magic have definitely become much more flavor of the month in academia, there was a long time when it was better for your career to stay away from that kind of stuff.
I see. Okay. I was wondering if we could talk about the relationship between magic and medicine that you talk about. Could you expand on that?
Yes. I mean, it's interesting. It's another case where, I mean, similarly to when I was talking about defining magic, you can get very tangled up in the words that you use and their history. So if you look at medicine in any pre-modern tradition, it looks very much like magic. There's not very much different from what we call magic and what we call medicine. So you can really see the history of medicine as, in a way, defining itself as something separate from magical practices, as becoming more evidence-based and more kind of based on the kind of physical sciences. So as you go further back in any tradition, the Buddhist, various Buddhist traditions, other places in the world, anything that we call magic, any manuscripts, the kind of things I've been talking about, the scrolls, the collections of magical spells, are as much about medicine as they are about magic. They're about, they contain as many salves and potions and cures as they do anything else. So the further you go back in time, the harder it is to distinguish magic and medicine, I would say. I mean, one thing, if we look at the Tibetan Book of Spells that I translate, is it's very rare that you get a cure that doesn't include some kind of recitation of a mantra, offering to a deity or visualization or so on. So there is a religious element to most of the practices that we might otherwise just call medicine. So you might, for instance, make up a sesame seed mix for curing stomach problems or something like this, but you say a mantra over it before you apply it. But similarly, in the European tradition, the Lord's Prayer or Hail Mary or something like this was said over cures and things in order to make them effective. So we can become sort of a bit tangled up in our own kind of modern versions of these words if we try to distinguish them, and if we try to use them to distinguish what was going on in the pre-modern period. Basically, what people end up doing is using words like magico-medical or medicine stroke magic, and there isn't really much more you can do than that. Magic is medicine, and medicine is magic in the in early Buddhist societies and in most pre-modern societies, I'd say.
I'm just curious, what were the Tibetan terms for medicine or magic that you were working with?
Mm. So there's a clear term for medicine, men, but and then there are a number of different terms for magic. And I would, as I say in the book, there isn't in Tibet or other Buddhist traditions that I am aware of a word that you could directly translate as magic. So I'm quite clear that I'm using it here as a way to approach the subject and kind of set aside a certain area of practices and rituals to look at under the name magic. But within the tradition, there isn't one word that directly translates as magic. So there's things like sorcery, mainly dealing with black magic or aggressive practices. There's words like illusion, and then there's words to do with curing, with medicine. So there isn't a sort of direct correspondence between one word for magic and one word for medicine in Tibet, and I suspect, you know, that distinction wouldn't really mean anything linguistically in classical Tibetan either.
Okay. So we've discussed some of the different types of spells that you were translating and learning more about. Who was it that was engaging with the spells? Who is administering them, and who is requesting them?
Mm. It's very hard to say. So I did try to go into this a bit, and not just in Tibet, in the history of magic across Buddhist cultures. So in the book, I look at some of the earliest evidence for Buddhist magic. For example, there's the Gandharan scrolls that are the earliest surviving Buddhist manuscripts found in the Afghanistan region. And among those, there's a Dharani spell for protection, basically, but against various ills, whether disease, spirits, and so on. And this is in a collection of mainly Buddhist monastic texts. There's commentaries, sutras, all kinds of things like that. So it looks very much like a collection of put together by Buddhist monks. So that's from the earliest evidence we have. That's one clue that it was the Buddhist monks themselves who were practicing these texts. There's another early collection from Gilgit in Ladakh, and here there's even more evidence that the monks themselves were performing magic as a kind of service to their communities. So in Gilgit, it looks like you had a very small Buddhist settlement, maybe just three or four monks, and serving a small village. This was back in the 7th, 8th century. And what we can see from the manuscripts is that they were writing out the protective Dharanis as a service to people who'd paid them to do this, so the patrons, local patrons in the local village. And sometimes, actually, some of the manuscripts they've written out and they've left the names blank, the bit where you'd insert the name of the person to be protected by the spells. So they seem to have been kind of preparing things, and then they would go to the people in the village and say, if you are in need of protection, then we've got something ready for you and we can have it done for you in a matter of moments. So there's evidence there in the early these early collections of manuscripts that it was monks who were doing this. Also in Gilgit, you get scholastic things, you get grammars for learning Sanskrit. It's all kind of part of the that kind of monastic activity, but also there's magic there. So there's good evidence in the manuscript tradition that it's monks doing it. And then if we look at, I do this a bit as well, look at some contemporary societies, for example, Buddhism in Thailand, you also see it's the monks that do services like preparing amulets and so on for the local community. So I think we can certainly say Buddhist monks were practicing magic. I think we can also say there may have been Buddhist practitioners who were not monks, and it's certainly the case in Tibet, where you have the Nyingma tradition, where these are kind of married householders who are instructors in Buddhism and also provide services in magical practices to their patrons. That may be more specific to Tibet than other Buddhist cultures, but we can certainly say, I think the evidence is there, that very strongly that monks in monasteries were providing these services. And again, alongside medicine, so you can't really distinguish these magical services from medical services. And there's a good book by Kenneth Zisk on Buddhist magic, kind of tracing, sorry, on Buddhist medicine, tracing the development of medicine in India through Buddhist monasteries. And again, with, as he said as well, with in some cases very little distinction between what we'd call magic and what we call medicine.
That's really interesting. I think there are definitely some parallels in the Theravada world of lay practitioners performing different magic rituals and monks as well. In contemporary Tibetan practice, is magic still something that monks are practicing and learning about, or is it more underground?
It is definitely still part of the, I'd say part of the sort of general education of monks, not the sort of monastic sort of university education per se in philosophical texts and so on, but anybody who's going to be in a community and kind of making their living as a teacher and as a kind of local Buddhist expert is likely to have some skills in this area. There are also people who specialize in this, so then there'd be kind of rainmakers, for example, or exorcists who might specialize in one area or another. It's not always evident because, again, it's not always the side of Tibetan Buddhist practice that is most publicized in the West, but it definitely is there in the education of Tibetan Buddhist monks and lamas.
Okay. In your book, you cover a range of very strange and obscure spells. I was wondering if you could tell us about the weirdest one that you came across, which was the most surprising.
Well, I mean, I was surprised to find spells that are just for... well, really for things that didn't really have any application to what we think of as Buddhism, and one would wonder really how sometimes the practitioners would justify using the spell. So, for example, there's a spell to bring two people together, a love spell basically, which involves writing their names on a piece of paper and putting them on their persons. So, and then there's the opposite of that spell, which is to break people up. Who, if there's two people who are in love and somebody doesn't want them to be together, there's a spell to break them up. And this is, you know, you can see why these would exist. And as I said, they'd exist in many different cultures. But one does wonder how they are justified in a Buddhist context. And then there are the more fun ones, which are for invisibility or flying or hearing things over and seeing them over great distances, which would be very interesting to try. They sometimes involve rather complicated procedures, though, like making special mixtures and dotting them all over your body, and then burning incense and then becoming invisible. So you'd have to be quite dedicated to try this out. And yes, as I said, I I haven't done so myself, and I don't recommend anybody try. And if they do, I won't be answerable for the consequences.
Have you ever seen any of the spells being performed in real life?
So I've seen the sort of the more monastic side of it, where the Dharanis are recited and so on for protection, or the Tormas are created, the ritual offering cakes, and then cast out for the establishment of a house or this kind of thing. Yeah, done again by monks. I guess, you know, I haven't seen the kind of thing that I just mentioned, the less obviously kind of the things that are less justifiable in a Buddhist sense, but certainly do seem to be there still in the Buddhist tradition.
In the book, you mentioned the Burmese Waksa, the kind of invisible wizards that also do these types of things. Do you know if there's any communication between the two schools of thought, or are they very separate traditions?
Yes, I'm not aware that they have been in touch, although it's very interesting because if you look at the Waksa, I mean, that word coming from the Sanskrit Vidyadhara, the name of the kind of specialist in spellcasting, and that word also exists in Tibetan as Rigtsin. So we have possibly a kind of common background to both traditions. And you know, whether there is a kind of tantric element to the Waksa tradition and the magic in that tradition or not doesn't really matter, actually. Because the Buddhist magic, as I see it develop in India, is something that comes along before tantric Buddhism, before Vajrayana, and is then kind of absorbed into it. But I think before that point, it seems to have had an impact on Southeast Asian Buddhist traditions, and it's there in Theravada. So I was interested to realize while writing this book that, for example, a very popular Dharani, the Ushnisha Vijaya Dharani, very popular in Tibet, was also big in India, does exist in Pali and is known in Theravada countries.
Yeah, you mentioned the spells for trying to get someone to fall in love with you or breaking up a pair of lovers. In the Thai tradition, they have special tattoos for things just like that, administered by a lay practitioner. So there are some common themes in the Theravada world, definitely.
Oh, yes.
I was wondering if we could talk about the final chapter in the book, which is a translation of this Tibetan book of spells that you're working on. Could you tell us a bit what the translation process was like?
Yes, and as I mentioned earlier, it actually occurred over quite a long time, because the first time I came across this little booklet was when I was working on a catalogue of all of the tantric manuscripts from Dunhuang along with Jacob Dalton, and it was just something I had a few days to go through and then move on to another manuscript, but it was really interesting. So at that point I realised that this very roughly written well-handled looking little book wasn't a single text, was actually a collection of lots of very small rituals, and though it wasn't easy to see looking at the book and the Tibetan text itself, they were divided by saying it, if you want to, you know, if you want to cure a headache, or if you want to break up two lovers, or so on, and then a very brief ritual and then saying what will happen. So I realized then it had this structure, and in the catalogue I wrote a kind of list of the spells as I understood them then. So that was the first stage. And then more recently, when I decided I was going to translate it, so I took that list, having that understanding that this was a compendium of spells, and started to translate them bit by bit. And it was quite hard work, I mean, because being used to working on Buddhist texts, I hadn't come across a lot of the things like the materia medica that are talked about here, or some of the medical terms for ailments and so on. And also, one of the things about this book is it was clearly written by somebody to use. So it's not very beautifully presented. It does contain mistakes, and it does contain little scrawls in between the lines where the person's written a note to themselves, basically. So in one case that I like, where it's spelled to stop somebody from being able to speak, it says to write something on a piece of paper and to put it in the mouth, and then they've written as a little note to themselves, put it in your own mouth, which makes the spell a bit easier, I think. So that it was a translation process that took a while. Other people probably find this with translation as well. In some cases, you can go through and really one pass or two passes might be enough. In this case, I had to return to it again and again to really understand better what the spells were for, what was being used in them, and what some of these quite obscure terms were.
Do you think you'll stick to writing about magic and spells, or try and find more texts like this now that you've done this translation, or are you moving on to different things?
Well, one of the odd things about this, the Book of Spells, is there isn't anything very similar in the Dunhuang collections anyway. What I did do a bit of work on in the book was looking at the later Tibetan tradition, where you have these compendia which are called Baobun in Tibetan, which are books of spells from the 11th century, where we have one by Bari Lotsoa, through to a late 19th, early 20th century Lama called Mipham, who wrote one of the most famous and one of the latest Baobun texts. So there is a whole tradition to explore there. Whether I will myself, I'm not sure. So I think, as you said, I moved from International Dunhuang Project to the Endangered Archives Program. This is a program that sponsors the digitization of manuscripts and other materials that are at risk across the world. And it has some fascinating Buddhist collections of various kinds, including stuff that will fall under the definition of my definition of magic. So a project by Valentina Punzi on Ngakpas in Ando, for example, and also medicine, medical manuscripts from India. So this is a really fascinating resource, which if I have the chance, I'll go a bit further into exploring, I think, and maybe it's still under the heading of magic. We'll see.
This is just an afterthought, but I was wondering, could you tell us a bit about Dunhuang? Because your Tibetan Book of Spells are part of this project, but we didn't really talk about what that is.
No, quite right. That's true. So the importance of that collection is that this is a small cave that was part of a much bigger cave complex near the town of Dunhuang in eastern Central Asia, now Gansu province in China. And in 1900, this complex of Buddhist cave temples was being renovated, and one of the walls was broken through, and this small sub-cave was found, which was stacked with manuscripts and paintings and some other Buddhist ritual material. And due to the sort of various colonial exploration and archaeological surveys going on at the time, a number of people from different countries visited, including Europe, France, Japan, and then the authorities from Beijing actually sent people down to gather what remained. So the collection of that cave then over the early 20th century was dispersed into institutions in London and Paris and across private collections in Japan, also in St. Petersburg and in Beijing. So the International Dunhuang Project was a project to digitally reunite that material. And the importance of the material is that when it was studied in the early 20th century, it was realized that the cave itself must have been sealed at the beginning of the 11th century. So it became a kind of time capsule for the study of Buddhism, history, the Silk Road, and so on. The collection itself was probably formed from the collection of Buddhist monks and monastic libraries. And it's roughly mostly Chinese and Tibetan, with some other Central Asian languages like Khotanese and Sogdian, and also Sanskrit. So it's a real resource for understanding Chinese Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism particularly, because it's actually the earliest manuscript cache of this kind in Tibetan Buddhism. And it's been fascinating working with it, and it always throws up new surprises and interesting discoveries. And the International Dunhuang Project continues, and I hope we'll continue to kind of represent a really important cooperation between these countries in the West, to which these manuscripts were dispersed due to kind of colonial activities, and the National Library of China and the Dunhuang Academy, which also have collections. So it's kind of represents a proper and really, really constructive international collaboration. And though I'm not kind of officially a part of it anymore, I do hope that it continues.
It's such an exciting and important project. Mm. I was wondering, just to wrap things up, other than your Endangered Archives program, is there anything else that you're working on research-wise?
Mm. So I'm working on gradually on the religious songs of a 15th century Tibetan monk called Karma Tindley. And the reason why is the Lama Jumpa Tai, the Buddhist teacher and academic that I mentioned, was my supervisor and also my Buddhist teacher. His Tibetan teacher was the current Karma Tindley Rinpoche. So I've always had an interest in his very eminent ancestor back in the 15th century. This Karma Tindley wrote on the Tibetan traditions of Mahamudra and the philosophical traditions of Madhyamaka and so on. So he was very a kind of very educated scholar, but also wrote very poetic and quite entertaining sometimes songs about being a Buddhist monk, going on retreat, dealing with his own failings and so on. So I'm going through that. It's a kind of different thing for me, away from the world of Dunhuang and other things I've been working on recently, and maybe that will turn into something at some point. But for now, it's just enjoyable to carry on translating and work on something which is interesting and rewarding.
That sounds great. Thanks so much for being here, Sam. I think we'll sign off there, and I hope everybody checks out your book.
Thanks, Olivia.